I think that part of the problem for many of the faithful, myself included, is that there's a yearning for the situation as it was, let's say, when Pius XII was pope and he
of
was
course.
Clearly the monarch
course,
and
course,
people would kneel down and kiss his
of
ring.
Of course, and he retired behind the screens and he was hidden away in the amber of the papacy, preserved in that amber of reverence. That day is past. Let me tell you something. Take Christ. He was, from what we know, a Caucasian. He was about 5'11", from what we know of the shroud. He had a strong body. He probably was brown-skinned, as all the Jews at that time were. He was probably dark-haired, from what we know. We're speculating on that part of it, his pigment. He walked around, and people addressed him as rabbi, master. And when they tried to make him king, he ran, he fled. And he refused to be crowned, refused to be accepted as a leader. And finally they got a hold of him, they stripped him naked and they scourged him, they thrashed him, and they crucified him, covered him with blood, and buried his body in a hurry to get rid of him, so that there would be no ruckus with the Romans. Now, of course, if I had met Jesus in Galilee, on the shores of the lake, or if I had seen him in Jerusalem in the week of his passion, I'd have adored him, fallen down in front of him. I'd have kissed his feet, as Mary Magdalene did, and adored him, and the disciples. But the wide world didn't. And why do I expect my Pope to be more reverenced than he was? Is the disciple above his master? So John Paul II is saying, okay, they have stripped us of our dignity. They have stripped us of the aura of divine authority. Let's walk as Jesus did and suffer this passion of calumny, detraction, commonization, bastardization of my status. I'll still walk with dignity through this passion. So why shouldn't he do that? If that, in his opinion, and he's Pope, is the only way he can get around. Is he getting along with in order to go along? Is he going along in order to get along with? Sure, just as Christ did. Christ went along in order to get along with. He didn't say, I'll wipe you all out. No, he didn't. He went along with it. He was a victim of the circumstances. But being Lord and Master of all circumstances, he turned it to finally into the salvation of the Church. Similarly with this Pope too. Why should we think he should be above his Master? No. We who know him should reverence him and pray for him. And we should venerate him. But Mr. Clinton is going to shake his hand. Mr. Cole is going to shake his hand. People are going to have breakfast with him and ask him to pass the salt. Sure they are. And call him Mr. Pope or Signore Papa or whatever it is. We have to put up with that just as they talk to my beloved Jesus, the Son of God. They talked with him as if he was just another rabbi. Rabbi, tell us what you think of this. The other rabbi said this. What do you say? And ate with him and slept with him by his side and walked with him. How many of the disciples were like that? Even after he rose from the dead, the disciples still said to him, when are you going to restore the kingdom of Israel? Because they wanted to be the chiefs, the presidents and the military men. Even then, before the Holy Ghost came, they didn't understand. So it's no fault of ours that we don't understand, but above all, let us not make a final judgment on this Pope until Our Lady comes, until the denouement takes place, until his vindication takes place. And pray for him in the meantime. He has the light, because Bernard, he needs light, the light of the Holy Spirit, every day, more and more, because we are now entering a dark, long night of civilization. And he's the Pope, he's the last Pope of these Catholic times.
Let's now take a look at this dark, long night which is descending upon the world, and the circumstances that the Church finds itself in today.
We're now entering what we call the geopolitics of reason. That is how men reason their way through the politics of the entire world. Geopolitics. The politics of the globe. Because if there's one thing certain today, Bernard, it is that we are now in a world which is already won. In a very subtle way that people don't realize. Today, all the money markets are globalized. What happens in Tokyo and the Hang Seng takes place in New York. What happens in Singapore and in London and Paris and Rome All these money markets are in one global situation. There's no separation any longer. The flow of capital and the flow of capital goods, by which nations live or die, by the way, that flow is determined by these markets. And our money is influenced by the yen, by the mark, by the franc, and vice versa. We now are in a new situation completely where already we're financially one, whether we like it or not. Whether we like it or not, we're financially in one ship.
There are no national economies anymore.
No.
Trillions of dollars flow every day between borders without any hindrance.
Because the men running it have no borders themselves. They're not French, they're not Chinese, they're not Americans, they're not British any longer. They're citizens of the world who have vast holdings. Now remember that every day on the international markets, something like $600 billion is sloshed around in various deals. And there are hundreds of thousands of small investors, anything from 20,000 to 200,000, small, picky investors. There are about 60 or 80 men, some women, but mainly men, who play with anything between 40 to 80 billion. They decide what nation lives and what nation dies. They decide if Somalia is going to be saved. They decide about Bosnia-Herzegovina, not the politicians. Why? Because they have the money. It's not that they're merciless. No, they simply are very, very wealthy, and they grow more wealthy. And their interests are universal. They're global. They decide our money, and they finally will tell Clinton what not to do. And he has not to do that, and he has to do what they tell him. Because we now remember that nationalism is no longer strategic. We don't need any longer to have a nationalism in order to survive today. There are other things that we have, and here's where the Pope comes up. The first geopolitics of faith, the clash between geopolitics of faith and geopolitics of reason takes place in the question of birth control and population control. And it's very important, because it's at the nub of the meeting in Denver and is, at the same time, the bugaboo of this nation today with the pro-life and the anti and the pro-abortion movement. And then the whole movement of medical research, fetal research, and marriage and the family. It's all bound up in one ball of wax. Here's the situation. Since the time of President Nixon in the 70s, there have been a series of executive orders by the presidents of the United States, every one of them, Nixon, Ford, Carter, Reagan, and Bush. Now, an executive order in these United States is an order that can't be gainsaid. The president makes it, and it is law to be applied. This executive order has declared that 13 countries are strategically necessary for the United States. And these countries are strategically necessary because they contain resources we haven't got and we need for our survival, mainly military, but then economic too. They contain large Catholic populations, like the Philippines. And the executive order says we must be intensely occupied in population control. Keep the population down. Why? Very simple. All these countries are underpopulated. By the way, there's one country in Africa which is overpopulated. Demographers, when they speak about population, they consider a country underpopulated when the ratio of people to the land is such that the people can't work the land for their own sustenance. And most countries in Africa are underpopulated. There aren't enough people to work their resources. We don't want them to get sufficient population. Why? Because then they will be developed countries. They'll cease to be underdeveloped, UNDCs. They'll cease to be LDCs, low development countries. They'll become viable, and then they have command of their own resources. And what about our strategic necessity? So this document, which is now public law, and has increased our spending of billions of dollars on Planned Parenthood and on birth control, sterilization, condoms, all sorts, anything that can stop stem population is now the law. It says we have to limit population for our survival as the United States.
It's actually become an international crusade.
Yeah, because it's law. We have declared, Mr. Kissinger and Mr. Nixon first formulated this, we have to limit population for our survival. It is strategic. It is as strategic as possessing a nuclear power. If we hadn't got the hydrogen bomb, we wouldn't survive. Similarly, if we don't restrain populations in these countries, we can't survive. Now, that's what the Pope is facing. When Clinton and he stood at Stapleton Aerodrome and on this podium And the Pope, Clinton, having spoken, a nice deferential welcome, by the way, there's nothing wrong with it. He behaved himself, in spite of his origins. The Pope spoke, and he made it quite clear where he stood on abortion. There you had the clash completely. The Pope would not yield, no yielding. And right through his whole visit, he stressed the same thing again with the young people and with everybody listening to him and the government listening to him, that I am here, I am not yielding on it. And if you want war on the point, we'll give you war. But we will not yield on this. And this is the big clash between the two things, the geopolitics of faith and the geopolitics of reason. There's more to it, though. There's much more to it. Because there's a worldwide depression. Every country is affected, including us. Solzhenitsyn said a couple of years ago in one of his letters that a country which has lost moral spirit can't last, no matter how rich it is. And today we know that the United States, our social order, our political order, is riven with corruption. We know that. The rise of crime, the absence of moral observance in marriage, the fact that homosexuality is now enshrined as an alternative lifestyle. We have homosexual marriages. We're going to have much more of that. We're going to have the homosexual family placed on a par with a normal family. In fact, heterosexual families are now regarded as funny. They're not as up to date.
And anyone who in any way criticizes this new order is immediately stigmatized.
They're politically incorrect and socially unacceptable. That's the condition of our situation. Whereas the majority of Americans, and I'm sure the majority of Canadians, don't want that, but it's foisted by evil, and it's maintained in public because the organizations have been very, very clever at it. So we have that. Number two, there is no Christian principle governing international movements. We didn't go to Somalia for the love of God. We're not dealing with Bosnia and Herzegovina for the love of God. Otherwise, we'd have gone in and done something about it. We will tolerate any suffering. We'll tolerate another Holocaust. Let our friends, Jewish friends, remember, and they know it. We'll tolerate anything if that helps our national survival, because we have lost direction. And there's no doubt about it. That's the evil and the immorality of America today. In spite of the fact, the majority of the people are God-fearing, are good. In a day's walk in America, I'm sure it's Canada the same thing, you'll find good people. You'll find the odd, this exception to every rule. But normally people are good. But they're helpless in the light of the evil that has descended on us all. And that evil is very simple. The law of God is now observed. Education is being totally secularized. Children are being taught errors from the very beginning. And there's a new system of education taking place, OBE, outcome-based education, which is totally un-Christian and is meant to de-Christianize the masses of children.
And let's take a look at the situation that the average family is faced with. The average family is under siege, and you don't know from day to day if you're going to keep your job. Every day you pick up the newspaper and you read about hundreds of thousands of layoffs here and there and everywhere.
That's going to continue. It's going to get worse, not better. Economically, we're in trouble. And no matter what the new administration of the United States, States says about its deficit package and new plans, we know the deficit is going to be much greater by 96 than it is now. It's not going to be solved. And we're going to have suffering. Now, on top of all that, comes the geopolitics of faith. And John Paul II says, and he has told the leaders, over and above your economic difficulties, over and above your financial difficulties, over and above the economic depression, I must tell you that there are punishments coming from the hand of God. There's worse than the Mississippi floods. There's worse than Hurricane Andrew. There's worse than AIDS. There's worse than the explosion of Mount Helena. There's far worse. There's far worse. Some of them listen to it like Gorbachev. Some of them don't. But he keeps on telling them that. And this is only a prelude to it all. Unless you convert to Jesus Christ, because finally the king of the world is Jesus Christ. He must be acknowledged on every flag and in every parliament and in every city.
Do you think that's why this new world order doesn't seem to be working very well?
Well, it's working very well from the point of view of the organizers. Money is one now. There's the one system of money. And the big decisions are made by few people and implemented in macro management worldwide. Oh, it's working. But we are not benefiting from that because we happen to be in the trenches. We're what my father called the poor bloody infantry, the PBI. We're not the privileged ones. But it's working.
So they don't mind if there's hundreds of thousands of layoffs every day, or if...
They don't mind the killings in Bosnia-Herzegovina. They don't mind the Holocaust. Any Holocaust, the Armenian Holocaust, the Jewish Holocaust, the Sudanese Holocaust, the East Timor Holocaust. They know all these things are going on. They supply the arms with which these Holocausts are performed. They don't care about the drugs. American chemical companies manufacture the chemicals necessary for the laboratories in Latin America, in Colombia and Peru, that make the drugs that are corrupting our people. They don't mind that. They don't mind that. That's money. So the New World Order is working perfectly, as far as the instigators of the New World Order goes.
Is there a place for Christianity in the New World Order?
None. There is no place there. There is for the moment. That's why they would like to get control of the papacy.
Is there a place for Christianity in the New World Order?
No. Not ultimately. For the moment, yes. Those who are managing the New World Order see the church in its structure, in its visible organization, as a source of social stability. It's schools, it's universities, it's people obeying what they're told to do. If you can get a hold of that organization, you literally control the lives of nearly a billion people. Remember, we are almost 1 billion people today, nominal Catholics. If you get that in train, under control, think of the power you have. But for the idea that these people would practice contraception, would not practice abortion, would insist on social justice for all nations and the proper distribution of wealth, superfluous wealth, who would vote against war as a means of making money. Remember, the merchants of death make money on war, as they do in Bosnia-Herzegovina now, as they do in Somalia, as they do in Indonesia, as they do in Africa, as they do in Angola, as they do in Latin America, as they do in Europe, as they do in Armenia. All that will be wiped out. Oh, no, that's no place for that. Behind it all, Bernard, there is this mysterious thing, which we must touch upon. And we can't say much more than what I'm going to say. There's no doubt about it that it's not merely that there are a crowd of men and women who are, strictly speaking, Luciferian. That is, they believe that this universe is dominated by an intelligence which is intracosmic, which is worldly, which is not God. It's Satan, really. And that if they carefully follow the dictates of this spirit of intelligence, they will create a safe and happy world for some people. For themselves. But there's much more than that. We have sufficient evidence to know that within the Roman Catholic institutional organization, Satan has been enthroned. He has been given a place by his adepts and surrogates amongst the clergy and amongst the people. And one of John Paul II's difficulties today is that he is frustrated. Because within the fold, within the sanctuary, as Paul VI said, there's now a positive influence by Satan who has servants among us. Servants among the priests, servants amongst the nuns, servants amongst the bishops, servants among the cardinals. He is being served. And therefore he can frustrate the will of the Holy Father and the will of Jesus through the Holy Father. We know this. The historical circumstances of the enthronement of Satan in the Church of Rome is something else. But this is a fact we have to deal with. We can't get rid of it until Our Lady comes with great power. Because once you do something like that, once that happens, God doesn't act immediately. He's a macro manager. He manages things in the long run. And if men turn their back on him, he lets them turn their back on him. He doesn't force them back. And there is this now power within the church, satanic power. It's Satanist. And it is influencing our actions and decisions as bishops and as priests and as cardinals and as administrators of the church. Until Our Lady comes and cleans that out, sorry pal, we have to carry it and fight it. That's why Satan has such power today. That's why there's such corruption. That's why grace can't work. Remember the early missionaries who went to China and Africa, they found that when they went into a village or a group of pagans, their first difficulty was physical. They ran into physical difficulties because Satan ruled there. He didn't want them there. And there are stories of true stories about trying to change the place names in streets from the name of a god to the name of one of the saints, and the ladder would be taken away from the man. He'd fall down and break his neck, and water was polluted, and there were physical difficulties because Satan does acquire physical power once you admit him to your household, and he has great power. Remember that the existence of Satanism in this country is an established fact, that we have at least 8,000 covens, Satanist covens, which include priests and nuns, as well as ordinary.
Do these people exist at high levels of government?
Oh, yes, they do. They do. Without mentioning any names, they do. Right through the government, in the church and in the state, and in the states. So that there is a presence of Satan today, willed and accepted. You know what appalls us as exorcists in this part of the country? Up to about the year 1975, people committed errors and finally became possessed. A small amount of them invited possession. Today, we find over 50% originally invited possession. People are now saying, possess me, give me power, give me strength, give me pleasure. There's this new reign of Satan, and he gets very angry when he's disturbed because his best PR job is to prove that he doesn't exist. He doesn't exist. Whereas he reigns behind every bit of wainscoting and in every bedroom and boardroom, where people worship him and pay attention to him. He has signaled victories like this, the fact that the North American Boy Love Association, the NAMBLA, is a recognized authority today. It's a public organization. And whereas the American armed forces now must have Wicca chaplains, witches for chaplains for witches. And they have a newspaper published by the expense of the American taxpayer. The thing is, besides homosexuality, there is Satanism, and it's rampant and rampant, and respectable. Because the argument is, you're a Roman Catholic, you want respect, you want your chaplain, you want your newspaper, you want your bank balance. I am a Satanist. I claim to worship Satan. I have a right to have my bank balance, to have recognition, to have my place in the public square.
And a right to have those holidays off that are part religion's
And we're admitting that. So that's where we have gone so far. The point to be noticed by Christians and Catholics above all is that Satan has been enthroned. And poor Paul VI, toward the end of his life, regretfully had to say, the smoke of Satan has entered the church, has entered the sanctuary, and is around the throne. He knew. He knew.
Was this foreseen by Pope Leo XIII?
Yes, it was. It was. And we know it all. When you examine all the evidence back from the last century to today, it all stacks up to the following. That in the latter years, in the last decades, and the last decade above all, of this century, the second millennium, Satan has a one last wild fling because Our Lady is coming. And he knows that's the end. That's the end of his reign. So his 1,000 years of freedom to destroy the church will be over by the end of this millennium. And this pope, this poor man, innocent in all he was chosen as Pope precisely at this moment. That's his fate, his terrible fate, that he was chosen to be the Pope. And after he dies, or after he's killed, or after he resigns, or whatever, then we have the mourning of the magician. We don't know what's going to happen. We do know Our Lady will come and save us.
Now let's take a look at something else that's happening that's probably related both to our discussion of the papacy and the dark night that's falling. It seems like old guards of any shape and stripe seem to be crumbling. People will pick up the newspaper and read, for example, that the monarchy in England is in serious difficulty, that institutions which dominated America's business scene, like IBM, are crumbling. Why do you think it is that all these age-old institutions are falling?
Because the civilization which gave rise to them, by the way, the Roman Catholic Church created that civilization, is at an end. It's the evening of the civilization. All the reasons for the existence of a monarchy with some decorum and some leadership power, some leadership role, they're gone. They no longer believe. They don't live Christian lives. They're no longer Christian in their behavior. They may have been baptized. They may not have. But the civilization as a whole, in its academia, in its public life, in its politics, in its war, in its peace, in its economy, is totally paganized. The civilization has ceased to be Christian. And the Catholic Church, which created a civilization, the Roman Catholic organization which did, is disappearing with it, and with the monarchy. And hence we have an outbreak of what students are now calling tribalism. You have the Walloons and the Flemings in Belgium who want to separate. You have the Bretons and the French in France. You have the Italians who want to split up. We're going to start splitting up too. There are going to be separatist and secessionist movements in the United States.
Happening already, both in the United States and Canada.
Yeah, it's going to happen. And according as the economic situation gets worse, and people get more desperate and resort to violence and arms, you're going to see much more disruption. And I'm always telling my own nieces and nephews, they don't believe me because they don't know. And they're all now, they're post-baby boomers. They were all born in the 60s and 70s. I always say to them, you don't know it, kids, but you have already lived the best years of your American lives. And you can say the same to people in Canada. You've already lived the best years of your Canadian life. You may not have liked it, but compared to what's coming, it was a paradise. But everything is breaking up. And that is because finally Christ has said, I'm turning my back on this civilization. It has ceased to be Christian. And I have no further interest in this race, apart from my sacrifice on Calvary and the salvation of men. And he's letting it break up. And you see, God has such power. Look, I can drink, I can eat, I can marry. But supposing I drink to excess, he doesn't send an angel and say, Malachi, stop that. No. He will allow me to corrupt my entire life and kill my body and go to hell for drunkenness. I can get married. I can also lecher. I can seduce and commit adultery and fornication. I can become a homosexual and get AIDS. I can kill myself. I can destroy my wife and children. In other words, Christ, if you misuse your powers, the natural powers given you, lets the misuse destroy you. He doesn't need to act. There's an inbuilt sanction, a sanction built into the world. You violate it, it destroys you. And that's his punishment, his real punishment, besides hell. But there's a real punishment built into human nature. We violate our rules. We accept our homeless as such. We will not punish criminals. We corrupt our system of justice so we no longer have a system of justice. All right, what are you going to pay? More people will be killed. More babies will be violated. More women will be raped. More men will be beggared. More people will die in misery and malnutrition. More people will hate each other. There'll be more violence. The punishment is built into it. And that's what civilization has its own seeds of destruction. And that's what is happening to us today. This thing is falling to pieces. There's no longer any reason why I should be honest with you. No longer why I should honor your wife. Why I should honor you. Why don't I seduce you or your wife? Take your money. Destroy you. Why not? It's a jungle. It's no longer the law of God. There's no longer a strong church voice. There's no longer a strong moral voice in my parliament. The parliament doesn't give a damn about Christ. The Congress of the United States doesn't give a hoot about the laws of salvation. Not a hoot. It will violate any law for its own advantage. And similarly, all other parliaments. Tell me one that doesn't. It doesn't exist. So the civilization is corrupt. It's no longer Christian. And Christ is saying, all right, the built-in sanctions are going to operate against it and destroy it. But when it's destroyed, I can build something else. And he will build something else. But this time it'll be the reign of Christ himself. That's the situation. So there's no getting out of it. And we'd better make up our minds that that's bad enough. But built into that is the battle between us, the war between us and Satan for souls. We are all responsible, primarily for my own soul, and then for those around me. But don't get any grandiose ideas that you can save the world, change it all back. You can't. The Pope can't. Because this is an ongoing one-way street. And at the end of it, there's a chasm. And the chasm is destruction of all that we've ever stood for, civilizationally and culturally. It's going out the window. We've bastardized our art, and we've bastardized our drama. There is no new, vivid literature growing up. There are no great poets, great dramatists, great writers, great philosophers. It's a desert at the present moment. People often speak about the change from communism in Eastern Europe. People forget that for 75 years, and for the best part of 45 years, most of those millions were bastardized intellectually by the great lie of the communist utopia. They were mongrelized morally by no law except the law of force. They were corrupt socially. They learned not to work, not to labor, not to make an effort. You couldn't change it. And suddenly, they're freed of all that. They can't recover overnight.
Let's take a look at that situation, because some economists were predicting that as soon as the monstrosity and the stupidity of the communist economic system disappeared, there would be an economic renaissance and a boom of unparalleled proportions.
Fools. They forget what Solzhenitsyn knew very well and said openly. A nation without a moral fiber cannot succeed with the best resources in the world, because finally ideas have consequences and faith must be there to create something. It was never created by pagans ever. They never created anything except in the life. Some faith, some religious faith. We haven't got any. God is expelled. And so there's this awful struggle now to try and maintain some equilibrium in the middle of a world depression. And it's not getting better. Everybody predicts it's going to get worse. How worse? God only knows. We do know that in the middle of it all will come the chastisements that have been promised us, which can't be mitigated.
And what are some of these chastisements that have been promised us?
Widespread hunger, widespread war, disease, then awful things which are exceptions like 3 days darkness over the entire world, baffling all our meteorologists and scientists who won't know what's happening, who will have various explanations, any explanation except the hand of God. There will be parts of the continent that will be washed away out to sea. There will be eruptions of volcanoes that are extinct for the last 20 million years. There are going to be family against family, disruptions of nations and of cities, the break up. How easy it is to paralyze a city with its sewer system and its electricity and its water and its power and its communications. Just destroy it. And we have already had a foretaste in the World Trade Center here where they're going to blow it up.
Well, certainly any large city is a sitting duck now for any terrorist who wants to plant a bomb in some skyscraper.
You know, I have a nightmare sometimes. I wrote about it in one book of mine, that people are sitting at their TVs looking at St. Peter's, and that dome is imploded with a bomb and collapses. I have a nightmare that's going to happen. We'll see it on TV. It will be destroyed.
And that would be a symbolic of the collapse of Western civilization as
That's
we
right.
know it.
And of the organization, the Roman Catholic organization. And when you look at it coldly and objectively, it doesn't matter two hoots, finally. God can manage all that. But that does mean that we're sitting on the brink of a coming catastrophe we can't change, we can survive, and it can be mitigated by prayer and patience and holiness. But we can't avoid it any longer.
What can a family do to protect itself? Because I know people that, let's say, figure that some type of socialistic government is going to take over. We're going to be in a worldwide depression, and they're making all kinds of preparations that say they're trying to store some guns in their basement. They are investing in financial instruments to make sure that they'll have enough when they retire. Is that going to save them?
No. No, it won't save them. It may help some of them survive physically, but morally about their children. What's going to happen to the children in the schools where they're taught pagan doctrine, where their outcome-based education makes them little robots because they're affective. The affective side of their character is under control. They've been taught to say yes and no according to the will of the state. And that's what's happening.
Well, it's even getting to a situation where it takes a heroic family just to hold itself together.
And it's going to be heroic, and it'll be more than heroic later, short time later. It may mean martyrdom. It may mean they will get rid of you by various means. You can get rid of people by evicting them, making it possible for them to earn bread, catching them on violations of rules made about their children's schooling, about finance, about their business. They will be martyrs. They finally will be martyrs. And anybody who wants to rear their children today must homeschool them to some degree. There's no good school any longer. Not really satisfactory. You've got to homeschool them, and besides letting them go into these institutions.
Are Christians perhaps entering once again into a situation which they first faced during the first three centuries.
Yeah. We are expelled. And today, in any normal dinner table in Manhattan or in Los Angeles or Atlanta or Chicago or Paris or London, if you dared say anything against homosexuality, if you dared say anything about abortion or fetal research, against these things or critiquing them, you won't be invited back. It's bad form. If somebody says, well, he's going to see his mistress, you're supposed to take that as marvelous. It's, or somebody says that, well, he's come out of the closet and he's a homosexual and he does this, that, that. You're supposed to accept that as saying that, well, he's changed his club. He has, joined a new organization. Today, we, and if we protest, if we say, no, I'm a Christian, I can't have anything to do with that, you're avoided. You're ostracized. You're regarded as funny, as a fanatic, as politically incorrect and socially unacceptable.
Is there perhaps a new form of totalitarianism, not in the sense that Hitler or Stalin were, but it's kind of a silent psychological totalitarianism?
Oh, yes. And we'll finally eliminate you, marginalize you. And Paul VI, to give him his due, did say that probably, not in his life, but probably, Catholics would become a minority on the fringe of civilization, marginalized. And we're already marginalized, by the way. In the city, New York, for instance, there isn't one Catholic voice speaking in municipal councils. Not one. Everything is decided on the principle of the big dollar or the big pleasure. And those who fool themselves, like the present authorities of the church, if they're friendly with and nice with these people, they'll get what they want, are finding out rapidly they get nothing. They're bastardized further and further and further and humiliated and eliminated finally. They have no power. So yes, it's heroic. It may lead to martyrdom. It may lead to martyrdom just to be Christian, just to be Catholic, just to rear your children. And there are laws now in the making where make it practically impossible for you to homeschool. And we know that the wife of the President of the United States, Hillary Rodham Clinton, has said she's going to wipe out all homeschooling.
Did she say that?
Yeah. Homeschooling, because it's interfering with outcome-based education. It's interfering with the control of the young people. And they intend to make these people serve their purposes of socialization and paganization.
So they have kind of an agenda of social engineering.
No doubt about it.
Replace the natural order of society.
No doubt in the wide world about that. No doubt in the wide world about it. Now, at the same time, Bernard, at least in principle, it's quite clear what a Christian and a Catholic must do. It's very difficult to do it because we have so many contradictory voices. We do more damage to each other as Catholics than we do to the outside world. We attack each other. Traditionalists fight against progressives. People who follow Father Feeney are attacked by the Pius X people. The Pius X people are attacked by the Pius V people and by other traditionalists. And there are snipers and marksmen all around just taking free shots at everybody. And then there's a whole slew of so-called heretical bishops who are ordaining their own flock. It's an extraordinary fact that we are trying to shoot each other completely, kill each other off, instead of uniting as one solid bunch saying, no, we're all Catholics, this is what we hold, let's band together. It's impossible to get them together. And on top of all that, then we have so many voices. And then people are doubtful about, for instance, you have Vasula Raiden, this amazing lady, Greek lady who now lives in Switzerland. And she has her writings. They're loved by some and condemned by others. She's derided by many people and adored by many other people as a true voice of God. There's Mother Teresa. But then how do you understand Mother Teresa? Mother Teresa's sisters, they're taking care of a Hindu who's dying. They say Hindu prayers with him. Hey, wait a moment. What's that mean? There are a few apostles that are clear. There are Catholic and Christian, like Fernfried von Straten, the bacon priest. There's no doubt where he stands. Paul Marx, there's no doubt where he stands. The present Pope, there's no doubt where he stands. But there are very few apostles, you can say, that is truly Catholic and Christian. There are very few of them. It's a mixed bag. You take the Knights of Malta, take the Knights of Columbus. They have members who are Masons. They have members who are active homosexuals. What is this? What is this? Are they Catholics? No, Catholics, yes, but the corruption of the entire organization is confusing to people. And then you have so many seers, or videntes as they call it in Spanish, so many people having visions and publishing them, with so many priests supporting them and so many priests against them, and you have traveling salesmen who have weeping statues and bleeding statues, that finally, you know, and then the derision poured on all that by non-Catholics and the hate, and then on top of all that you have the corruption of the clergy, the pedophilia that goes on. There's just another priest now caught, a Monsignore, caught in New York Archdiocese. So there's this it's decadence, it's shambles.
It's a common thread to all these groups within the church. Every religious order is that it's faced with a breakdown of unity. I don't think there's a single religious order that hasn't been divided.
Not one. Jesuits, Dominicans, Carmelites, Franciscans, and they're all in revolt against each other, and then they also have opposition to the Holy Father. There's no unity any longer. There's no unity any longer.
But humanly speaking, could there be one person that would come and restore it? I don't think it's possible.
No, it must be Our Lady. It must be a supernatural thing. And she has... Listen, Bernard, let's be awfully frank, even if people don't want to accept it. We know the agenda. We know the agenda very clearly. We're going to go on slipping down the slope. We're a big thing, it's a long slope. But we're very near the edge of that chasm over which we finally topple. And we're going to topple over it. And there's going to be chaos. What they call nowadays ordered chaos. Chaos under control. And there are going to be natural calamities, as well as man-made calamities, mistakes made by people. And finally, there are going to be calamities that come upon us from the hand of God. And people will say, my God, this is not caused by nature. This is something else. And at the end of all that, Our Lady will come, and there'll be a sign in the heavens, meaning she has come. And everybody will see that sign. They will know it. They will know it calls them to their conscience. It doesn't mean they're going to be converted. It means that those who are already converted will get better. It means that those who are wobbling may, if they want to, be confirmed in their faith. It means that the others who don't believe and refuse to believe will say, we can despair. There's no way out. It's simply God putting people on notice that things have changed.
But is it also Christ saying, I give you one more chance?
Yeah, it's God saying there's a refurbishment going to take place. I will have an apostle in charge of you now who is going to be an apostle who will have the power to change things, because he must give the power. And remember, John Paul II, that poor man, Carol Wotiwa, he hasn't been given the power by God to change things. But there will be a pope, a leader, Christianity, arising who will change it all, because he will have the power built into him. John Paul II is supposed to preside over the decadence and the failure and hold things together as long as possible, because there are people to be saved still. But the man who will do it is somebody after his death, not the next pope, but somebody else. And that's the mystery of what's coming in the future. And all we can hold on to is the fact that we can say our rosary, we can receive a valid Holy Communion, we can be absolved of our sins by a validly ordained priest, we can die with the rites of the church, we can save our souls, we can protect our children to a certain extent until they leave the nest. We can save our souls. That's all we need do. I will not be asked anything more by Christ. He will not say, what happened to the church in your time? Why didn't the Pope do this? He will not say that to me. He won't even talk about the bishop to me. He'll talk about me.
So ultimately, that's the only thing we've been promised is our salvation if we hang tough
and keep the law and maintain our Catholicism.
So we're not necessarily promised a situation which we're going to have a thriving civilization.
No, it's not going to be beer and Skittles. It's not a milk run. It's a tough chore. As I say, I'm always saying to my nieces and everyone, friends, look, you've already lived the best years of your American lives. You may not know so, but it is so. Look around you. Read the signs of the times. You know, Bernard, it's a good thing to end up on the meaning of the word, the signs of the times. You know, Christ said to He said, you know, you're an evil and adulterous generation. He told his contemporary Jews. And he said, you ask me for a sign. He said, tell me, why do you stop where you stop? At sunset, you can say, well, tomorrow's going to be such a day from the reading of the sunset. In the morning, you can read the wind, the direction of the wind, and you can read the skies. You say what's going to happen during the day. And he said, you can predict political events for your political affairs, your economic affairs, military affairs. He said, why don't you read the other signs of the times about God? You're corrupt. You're sinful. He's punishing you bit by bit with the Roman occupation of this country of ours, the Judea. Why don't you read those signs and repent and he will save you? But you don't. Why do you stop where you are? And he said, this evil and adulterous civilization will be given only one sign, the sign of Jonah. The Son of Man will be buried for 3 days and will rise again. His resurrection is the only sign of salvation. If you don't believe in it, bye-bye, birdie.
And that's much more important than reading all these signs that you read about in the newspaper, economic indicators and...
If you have to for your business as a broker or a doctor or an investor, do. Or for looking for jobs, for your children, for your family, for your wife and or your husband, or whatever the case may be, that's fine. But the chief thing is, are you reading the signs of the time? Do you know where we are? Do you know what's coming on top of us? Have you secured your soul? Are you living with uncleanness in your life, or in your children, or in your wife, or your husband, or your employees? Are you cohabiting with evil? Are you entertaining Satan in his jackboots as he strides around our boardrooms and bedrooms and streets and parliaments? If you are, then bye, bye, birdie. You have neglected grace. You haven't read the signs of the times. So it's tough today. It's either or. I must tell you, Bernard, that Christ has come to the point, as Werner von Straten said, he's deserting our tabernacles. You don't show me reverence. You don't revere me. You don't take necessary precautions to have a valid sacrament. I'm leaving you. I'm walking away from you. You see, the point is, he doesn't need us. He desires to need us and wills to need us. But if you turn a blind, like the rich young man, he said, he loved him and said, look, sell all you have and come and follow me. And the young man was very sad because he was very rich. And he went away sad. That's what men can do. They can look Christ in the face when he comes. He passes by every man and woman once in life at least and looks at them. And it's always an invitation. May I come in and sit with you and stay with you forever? If they say no, too bad.
We have been discussing how difficult it is for a family to preserve itself and hold together under the forces that are working against it. What are some of these forces that are working against a family, and how have families' lives been influenced in ways perhaps which people don't even realize?
Well, Bernard, now that we can look back over a sufficient stretch of time, like, say, 20, 25 years, it is now quite obvious to everybody that there was a plan implemented to affect the public and private behavior of ordinary citizens. We now know that because those who formulated the plan have spoken very frankly about it. They set out to mold our language, to accustom us to see much more explicit TV, to get accustomed to violence as if it was normal, to see violent and disruptive sexuality portrayed on the video, on the TV and in films, much more than our grandfathers or fathers would have admitted, or we would have admitted 40 or 50 years ago, and to change our mode of thinking and talking, and in general to lower the level of moral and religious expression in language itself, so that now our language has been vulgarized. We use words today we would never use before. For instance, I never expected to hear the mayor of New York talking about condoms in public. You just didn't do it. Or talking about the homosexual act in detail, which they do now explicitly. But my children, if I had children, would be taught that in schools with diagrams. And we have, most parents accept that. Sex ed, as they call it, is even in Catholic schools. Whereas in my day, if one of my teachers told my daddy and my mom that he was going to teach me sex ed, daddy would have knocked him down, I think. He wouldn't have accepted it.
And rightfully so.
And rightfully so, because he did all the teaching about sex ed we needed. with his large family of 9 children. But we have accustomed ourselves to hand that into the hands of externs, to people who have not our religion, and to be drawn up by people who live in faraway places like Albany for New York, for instance, the state education system. So that this is the first thing we have to fight against. There has been a plan to mold people's minds along a certain way, to de-Christianize them, de-Catholicize them, to a certain extent to de-Americanize them. Because now what's in Haiti is reciprocity, cultural multiculturalism, aid not the victim but the criminal. It's a funny turn of mind that the criminal has much more chance of pity and compassion than any victim, whether they're killed or raped or robbed or maimed or whatever it is. So there's an attempt to change our minds so that from the principles of justice and of chastity and purity and rectitude that we were reared with. That's there. That's number one. That's one difficulty we're up against. Another difficulty we're up against is this that has now become very much, it's worse than smoking in public. You shouldn't talk about religion. You can't even say, well, I'll have a silent prayer. That is offensive, apparently, for somebody to say, well, I'm going to say nothing because I want to pray silently. That's very offensive, especially in little children. That violates the separation of church and state, apparently. And similarly with things like abortion and contraception, if you condemn these things in public, where was your friends, say, that part of public behavior, the people will say, well, don't be so extreme, don't be so fanatic about this. Be real. People don't share your point of view. But they can talk about their abortion and their choice of women's, their women's choice, and my body is my own. But you can't talk about the other side of it without being considered a fanatic. And that's the turn of events, that it's become unfashionable to be religious. And if you are religious and people know it, they regard you as peculiar, as somebody on the fringe. You're not normal. You're not normal. And similarly, as regards sexuality, the practice of sexuality, today, nobody is surprised when a young man and his fiancée sleep together for a year before they're married. Nobody can. In fact, if you say they shouldn't, people say, what's up with you? It's quite normal. That's the snag. And parents have children sleeping at home who have their lovers in, their future husbands in, or their lovers in, considered to be part of the liberty, that their body is their own. So you have this difficulty, and it's peer pressure on your children, if you have children.
It's a very, very strong peer pressure. Let's say an example of it, I run up against whenever I suggest that I and my wife may want a large family. You immediately get, they look at you as if you have two heads.
That's right. What are you thinking of? Or what, I mean, they can't understand it. And then I have people, young married couples, say, no, we want to have a good time for the first 5 or 10 years, and then we'll have children.
And I've heard that many times.
Uh-huh. And then they find out after 5 or 10 years that either she can't have children, or it's very difficult, or they don't want them, because money has got tighter, and they don't see the way to paying for it. So it's they're always caught by their own sins, by their own errors, by their own commissions. But these are the difficulties that are facing people. Then finally, there is the fact that whatever sources of education there are, newspapers, magazines, TV, radio, they are anti-religious and they're pagan. There is no semblance of Christian doctrine implied by them in the normal film. There's no semblance of. The most you can get would be what they call American values. And even those are distorted because there's always a political slant, left or right, to it. And so today we're faced with the fact that the civilization has deteriorated into a non-Christian civilization. And you just keep religion out of it. Everything will be fine if you keep your religion out of it. Don't bring your religion into it. Be as religious as you want to in private, in the closet. But don't come out of the closet. And above all, don't expect us to accept it.
And it becomes difficult to pass it on to one's children because they're exposed to
in school.
Television, school, blaring away at them that kind of ideas are old-fashioned.
And the behavior of their companions, too, regard it all as fuddy-duddy, to be otherwise. And everybody's doing it, so why don't they do it? And then there's the love of toys, the love of pleasure, the love of excitement, the love of food, and to do what they want, to have their own will. And their parents must become their friends, not their parents. Cease to be parents and become their pals, which disrupts the whole idea of motherhood and fatherhood and sonhood and daughterhood. And the family itself finally perishes. So these are the difficulties they're up against. And you know, Bernard, you and I know you can do all you can. You can get the best books. You can lecture your children. You can give them examples. But if you haven't got the grace of God with you, it won't succeed. Because they must get grace. And that means they must practice their religion. They must learn their prayers. They must go to the sacraments. They must be taught. They must be corrected. You must curb their passions. You must teach them that what the others do is wrong. Or not for us anyway. And that's very tough job. Tough love is a very difficult love to practice as regards your children today. Because they're afraid of losing their children. They want to be loved by their children. Whereas I don't think the destiny of parents is not to be loved by their children, but be respected. Love comes later. But love is very tough love, it must be. Now, they're part of the difficulties. They're worse than that, though, by way of difficulties, because willy-nilly, all our nations, yours in Canada, mine in the United States, and all of them in Europe, are now engaged in a new world order where the rule is money and industrial expansion and commercial activity and commercial success, where success is measured in terms of money, and after that then in terms of the men or the women that you consort with, not necessarily marry, in your popularity, in how rich you look, how exotic you look, what sort of an exciting life you lead. There's no cultivation of virtues in public at all any longer. Nothing is lauded along that line. They will laud somebody who's a role model in golf or in tennis, but they're not role models for eternity. There's no spiritual element present in it at all. And that's all part and parcel of this complete reordering of world affairs around to commercial and economic success. And the old values are gone.
Let's take a look at this, because it seems like both in the United States and in Canada within the last year, there's been a changing of the guard. And
it's a funny darn thing, that change of the guard, because don't you see a parallel between, say, President Reagan on the one hand or President Bush on the one hand and Mr. Mulroney on the other hand? They were cut from the same cloth, one way or the other.
Right.
Even though one is an American and one is a Canadian. And similarly between the new person in Ms. Campbell in Canada,
yeah.
And, say, President Clinton and his wife, Hillary, who's as much a power, if not a greater power, than he is in the American presidency. They're both cut from the same cloth again.
And they both have kind of a new concept of morality.
Absolutely new. The Clintons are absolutely clear on their mind. If you want to practice homosexuality, they're going to help you. They're going to have a law for you. If you want to kill your baby, they'll finance you right up to the third trimester. If you want to do fetal research on living babies, they'll finance you. So they have a completely different worldview.
And in their personal lives, that seems to hold true as well, because in their personal lives, they haven't practiced like the old morality in the same way, let's say, that the Bushes or the Mulroneys did.
No. That's all gone. They're not church-going, God-fearing Christian parents or couples. No, they're not. It's very different from that. They are the new generation of the... They're really Christian trash.
It's in a way, it's the generation that has grown up in the post-Christian world is
now
taking power.
That's right. The same thing in France and Germany and Italy. Same thing in Spain. There's no difference. It's universal. There's a change of role. And it's coming to the fore now, people who I don't think ever knew what a Christian civilization was. They know it from afar. They were never part of it. And consequently, their direction of affairs is pagan. They try and understand, and then when they see their own good is involved, they'll behave themselves. But they don't believe in it, they don't live it as such. And they see nothing wrong with killing newborn babies or killing babies in the womb. They see nothing wrong with homosexuality. They see nothing wrong with fetal reserve, provided it doesn't cost too much. And as for the rest of the moral law, it's what you can get away with, really. But don't be caught at it, if necessary. And there's a crassness there. There's a certain crassness as regards human life, as lacks a touch of compassion and gentleness, which is only found in people who are religious-minded.
Yes, and charity has grown cold.
Oh, yeah, it's frozen out completely. It's frozen embers. It doesn't exist. So that's what we're facing. And we can't expect any other thing for the moment. It's going to get worse. Because this thing now is taking over because people are getting desperate. It's now getting very difficult to live. It's now getting very difficult to manage things properly.
Just even to hold on to a job is becoming difficult for many families.
That's right. That's right. It is. And I know a few families that sacrificed everything to retire to the country in various places in Canada, here in the United States. But they're finding that they have got to get back to the city again. They can't find work. They can't find money. They won't be able to feed their children. It's a bad time from the point of view of that. And it's going to get worse. It's not going to get easier at all. So that's the situation in which we find ourselves. And either you take that in the spirit of faith and utilize the weapons of faith, or else I think you're going to be lost. I think you're going to go under, and your families and your children. And then your marriage will go under finally. It'll be a hopeless world. And there's another difficulty too, which you mentioned. This is about, remember you mentioned something about the squabbling, intra-Catholic squabbling that takes place.
Yes. You see, you talked earlier about the fragmentation that's evident in, let's say, in Canada and the United States, where people, let's say, think of themselves, we'll use the United States as an example, they think of themselves not as an American, but as a black or a white
somebody. That's right. They do. They fall into sub-tribalism, we call it. It's called tribalism by the demographers.
But you see the same thing in the church now, too, right across the spectrum.
It's fantastic. And when I find out that the members of the Pius X Institute, Lefebvre's Institute, are fighting with the members of Pius V, who are fighting them, and then the followers of Father Feeney from Boston, now in New Hampshire, they're fighting them all. They're being attacked by the others. And on top of that, you have other various factions of traditionalist priests who have nothing to do with nobody. And it goes on and on and on. They're all firing and flailing away at each other in the most extraordinary way. And this, they should be really defending each other, attacking those who are attacking the church. They don't, though. They spend a lot of time writing against each other and attacking each other and disrupting each other's meetings.
There is kind of a loss of perspective.
There is.
They're all engaged in their inter-family squabbles.
Each one wants to win. And there are several questions, I think, which would be useful for your listeners and my listeners to know about or to have thought about. One is the whole question of Archbishop Lefebvre. Another is the question of the Father Feeney group and what they're saying about salvation outside the church. I think we should deal with both of those because they're big questions. Because I went out and gave a lecture to a certain organization here, a very well-known organization, about the church. And I happened to say in it that unless you're a member of the church, you won't be saved, which is normal Catholic doctrine. Oh, the priest nearly hit me. The priest and the chaplain, who was my host, and he tried to contradict me later on. We had a huge discussion about that. So some clarity must be given to people's minds. What about a good Jew? Or a good Mohammedan, or a good Methodist, or a good Mormon, are they damned because they don't belong to the Catholic Church and have refused it, or never heard about it, or anyway never belonged? Are they damned? If we say outside the church there's no salvation, where does that leave the room for anybody to be saved except those who are baptized Catholics? Because that the doctrine of the church is there may be baptism of desire, there may be baptism of blood, we don't know. We only know baptism of water. And that means that a priest or another human being stands over you, pours water, while saying, I baptize you in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. If they don't do that, strictly speaking, dogmatically speaking, you're not saved. You can't enter heaven. You may go to some lower order of things, some limbo, but you can't enter heaven. You can't see God forever. And what about the babies that are born dead, or the stillborn babies, babies aborted? What about all the embryos, their souls, their babies too? What about all those? Are they all condemned to the outer darkness? Is that what God's mercy and compassion is all around? So it's a wide swath. And then there are millions, literally, as Carl Sagan would say, millions and billions of beings in China and Japan and India who never get near the church, never get near Christ, never get near the Blessed Sacrament, never get near confession, baptism, never. So it's a big question and has tortured the minds of theologians since the time of Columbus, because that's the first time it hit them, that there was a problem about the salvation of people who are not baptized. Now, as regards the doctrine of the church, it is a very simple doctrine, really. It's this, that if you're saved, I don't care if you are a voodoo priest in Haiti, or if you worship the sun god in Tasmania, or if you're a pious Jew, or a not-so-pious Jew, or a pious Mohammedan, or a not-so-pious Mohammedan, whatever you are, if you're saved, it's because of the grace of the Roman Catholic Church, because there's only one source of grace in the cosmos. That is the Holy Roman Catholic and Apostolic Church as the mystical body of Christ. You can't get grace otherwise. Now, if that's so, how does it work? Well, the church says that it works like this. If you are a good non-Catholic, a Methodist, or a Haitian voodoo priest, or whatever you are, if you observe your conscience successfully, it's very difficult without grace. St. Thomas says it's practically impossible. But supposing you do, and you die in that condition, then God, in virtue of what you've done, without any help from him, he hasn't let you see a priest or be baptized or get a chance of learning about the doctrine of the church. In that case, because of that, he will grant you the grace of the Roman Catholic Church, so you're still saved because of the Roman Catholic Church. You can't be saved independently of it, because it's the only source of grace. That's the rule, and there's no exception to that. And we must touch on one thing which will walk on somebody's toes, but it must be touched upon. It's the question of the Jewish covenant with Abraham and God. There was an attempt at the Second Vatican Council, and since then, to say that the covenant, the Abrahamic covenant between Jews and God, was distinct and different from and quite viable all by itself from the Christian covenant. And therefore the Jews needn't be converted. And that they would be saved by merely being good Jews, merely that. That is Christian heresy. There is no such thing. The Abrahamic covenant was wiped out as regards salvation. But those belonging to the covenant will get a special grace because they happen to be Jews. But there is no salvation in the Abrahamic covenant. You cannot be saved by merely being a Jew. And people don't want to hear that. They consider that to be anti-Semite. It's not. If it's anti-Semite, it's the doctrine of the church, and the church will not change. And that's the first thing about it. The second thing then concerns the doctrine, really the history of the supporters of Father Fini. They were condemned unjustly, and they were excommunicated unjustly. There was no excommunication, really. And 4 or 5 years ago, the Vatican told them that there was no excommunication. Nobody died excommunicated. Father Fini himself was not excommunicated ever. Nobody ever was. It was a mistake. It was a mistake. So that any idea of calling it the Boston heresy is a misnomer. There was no heresy. He was teaching the normal doctrine of the church. Except that, under pressure, he went to an extreme. Because he was fighting against people who denied it all. And his expulsion, and the expulsion of his brother from the Jesuits, and his expulsion from the Jesuits, and their condemnation was engineered by people like Cardinal Spellman and Cardinal Cushing, who did not want to offend their Masonic friends and their non-Catholic friends. So it was totally unjust. And one day later, Bernard, not now, but some day later, the church will reinstate Father Fini and say it was all a ghastly mistake. He wasn't excommunicated ever, either officially or unofficially. The whole thing was a misnomer, was an anomaly, was a mistake, was prejudice, was slander and calumny. The man is probably a saint from the moment he died. That's number one about the Fini case. On the other hand, the Archbishop Lefebvre case is something else. Was he excommunicated? And were his bishops excommunicated? And are all those belonging to and going to his masses throughout the world, are they excommunicated? Are they schismatics? Are they separated from God? If they die, do they go to hell? Can you go to Mass on a Sunday to one of their churches and satisfy your obligation? Can you receive the sacraments from them? Can you be anointed them when you die? Can they bury you? Or is all that bad, bad, bad and forbidden? The answer is awfully simple. Only once did the church in that matter talk about schism, and they've never talked about it since. They stopped calling him schismatic because they knew he wasn't schismatic, Archbishop Fable. They did excommunicate formally him and the four bishops and the assistant bishop. But nowadays, nobody believes the excommunication was valid. Nobody. Even the Romans. They know it was a formal action designed to frighten people away from him, but that they weren't excommunicated. He didn't die excommunicated. In Rome, this is the normal thing said, admitted nowadays, behind closed doors. They won't admit it in public yet. In time, they will send out a letter or a document saying that, unfortunately, a mistake was made. And the impression was given that this man was excommunicated with all his bishops and his people. And it was wrong. They weren't. They were quite all right. That will come in time. But it'll take time because the animus and the hatred of Lefebvre is still very high. Very high. And the official stance is he's excommunicated. But everybody knows he isn't. Then the Pope himself and several cardinals have already published statements saying anybody can go to their churches for Mass on Sunday. Anybody can receive the sacraments from them, including confession and Holy Communion. Anybody can be anointed when they die. Anybody can be buried by them out of their churches. Now, they could not say that unless they were convinced there was no schism, there was no excommunication. So it's one of these Roman anomalies where the Romans made a mistake through prejudice and where innocent people have been lampooned. But it's left a scar on the past, the 10th Institute.
Now, what's interesting is that the controversy of outside the church there's no salvation, and the Lefebvre controversy are two controversies that refuse to die.
That's right. Yeah, they refuse to die, and this is one of the things which Lefebvre achieved. He said once, it's true, that he was going to put a fishbone in the gullet of the Roman bureaucrats. They couldn't swallow it and they couldn't cough it up. The difficulty is they can't change him. It's too well established economically and commercially and financially. They're independent. Rome can't withdraw their money. It can't take their buildings. The buildings all belong to a separate legal entity. And this is what angers the Romans about the whole affair. They think that he's untouchable. And they're now talking now and again to him and ask him to come down and talk with their father, Schmidberger, or somebody come down and talk to them, and they say, yes, we'll talk, but the conditions are these, and of course those conditions are unacceptable to the Romans, and therefore the talk break down. And then they wait for a while, and then they come at it again. Because the past the 10th people are not going to give up. If they perish, it's by internal trouble, internal combustion, not because Rome takes them over. And if Lefebvre had given in to Rome in 1986 this all took place, something like that, the society would not be dead. They'd have taken it over, liquidated it. The Romans would have. He saw the danger and said, wait a moment, we won't go along with this charade.
Well, certainly he did put a monkey wrench in attempts to eliminate the Roman Mass.
Oh, he did, yeah. They can never eliminate the Roman Mass, apart from Lefebvre, but now with Lefebvre's crowds practicing it in propaganda, having a huge following, running into the millions, financially secure and independent, in several nations all over the world, with a certain unity about them, they're beaten at their own game. They can't do away with it. And therefore they set up the Ecclesia Dei and had the indult, the mass indult, which are only excuses, really. And they had the Fraternity of St. Peter for organizing, ordaining priests.
What is interesting is that there's been a whole generation of young people have grown up in the post-1960s liberal era, after the changes are made in Vatican II, after the revolution that swept through our secular society in the 1960s. Mm. And these are people who are attending the traditional Mass. They may be going to the kind of meetings that were in Denver.
That's right.
They haven't been totally corrupted by this wave of liberal...
No, on the contrary. They're very conservative, strictly conservative citizens as well as Catholics. They won't be corrupted, but they're very adamant about it. And they insist on saying we're part of the church. We're a living part of the church. We're the best part of the church because we're keeping the ancient rite. And they can't be eliminated. They can't be eliminated. This is what angered the Roman bureaucrats. This really angers them and still angers them, because if they could buy it out, if they own the land, if they own the money, if they could close the seminaries. But the Lefebvre's are getting nuns and vocations and priests, and they're founding schools. They're going on. And they'll go on living for a long, long time. And they'll cohabit with Rome for a long, long time. And they're not going to give in. And they're very fervent. A lot of them are very young, therefore they don't know the cost of being fervent. But that's what the situation in Rome has. And Rome has stopped talking about excommunication and about schism. It doesn't talk about those things in relation to it. If provoked, it does. But it won't normally start insisting on this, because they know there's a very murky question there about the excommunication, and that they can't call them schismatics, so they're not in schism. They're not in schism. They support the Pope much better than most bishops do. They're very faithful to the Pope. They declare he's the Pope, he's infallible, he has primacy of jurisdiction, he's the overhead boss, he's not merely a peer amongst equals. A lot of the bishops and cardinals themselves.
Well, certainly traditionalists in general do a much better job of adhering to the Church's teaching on contraception than regular Catholics.
Oh, much better, much better, much better. So the one has got to be very careful about both the Father Fini doctrine and about the saying that the Pius the Tenth people and Pius the and Archbishop Lefebvre's crowd are all schismatics and heretics.
Thank you, Father Martin, for taking part in these interviews. Before we close, I'd like to give an address where our listeners can get a hold of your books. And these books can be purchased at Angelus Books of Barry, and the address is 38 Giles Court, Barry, Ontario, Canada, L4M4L7.